papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis from veteran journalists talking about what we know, and that is how news is made in newsrooms and what the ethical standards are in those newsrooms. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, my colleagues. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. What's on your mind this week?
Maybe it's the baby boomer in me, but I'm genuinely concerned about network news, especially CBS. You know, I was away for a while. I came back and I said, what the heck has happened over there? They've appointed someone as editor-in-chief who has no experience. And so, you know, we all know that experience counts for something. So I'm worried about CBS.
Okay, we'll talk about that in just a second. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. What are you thinking about today?
I'd like to see us pursue what Judy is talking about, because there are already ramifications at CBS of having caved to demands that they should never have caved to in the first place.
Absolutely. That's a good topic. I'm interested in this notion. Just this past week, we found new reports that confidence in the mass media is historically low, with fewer than 3 in 10 Americans now place any trust in newspapers, television, radio to report the news fairly, fully, and accurately. The declines there across all major partisan groups, though Republicans' confidence is now even lower. But what was interesting is, if you look deeper into the statistics, there are individual journalists who are rated high. Anderson Cooper, David Muir of ABC, for example. People know journalists that they like, that they trust. It's the general institutions that they don't. And I'd like to suggest that an alternative, a great way to build trust, is in local journalism, is in state-level reporting, so that it's not the big national organizations that are making the difference. You know, it is those, especially now the emerging not-for-profit newsrooms. Like we were just reading this week about Nebraska. There's a great nonprofit newsroom out there called the Flatwater Free Press. And a young reporter named Destiny Herbers found that a very surprising fact, Nebraska officials are very excited about the fact that they have a low rate of drug-related deaths, under 12 per 100,000 people, which is the lowest rate in the country. Well, the reporter looked into why this is the case. Turns out that it's because other states have medical examiners who determine the cause of death. In Nebraska, that job falls to county attorneys, and most of them haven't reported a drug death in years or even decades. Now, that is the kind of ground-level reporting, fact-based reporting, that can really make a difference, that can build credibility. And it's, I think, why we need to see support for local news organizations, regional organizations like WAMC, because there, people can actually see the results of the reporting.
And that's a great example of knowing that you have to dig deeper and not just accept the statistics as they are presented. We get statistics all the time, reports all the time, and sometimes they're slanted in putting the report out in a good light. And sometimes they might be thinking that this is a fair report of the data that they've collected, but they really haven't dug deeper to ask the why. And that Nebraska story was a great example. That is labor intensive.
That's true. Great reporting is often that, right?
And doesn't this illustrate the value of a journalist? Because you need a skeptical, thoughtful, smart journalist to actually dig deeper. I imagine Kansas put out, or Nebraska put out, a number of press releases touting the fact that its deaths were so low. And it took someone to say, hey, wait a minute, let's take a closer look at it. This is the kind of information you're not going to get on social media. This is the information you're only going to get from a real reporter doing real digging, and to have the story vetted by an editor. I mean, there is a process involved. There are stories like this that aren't being covered every day. I mean, there's always been stories that haven't been covered, but man, I just shudder to think of what's happening that we're not covering because the local news reporters aren't there in the numbers that they once were.
Exactly that. Okay, back to the national media for just a moment here. CBS News. It's a new era at CBS because Paramount has spent $150 million to buy something called Free Press, which is a newsletter created by a woman named Barry Weiss, who used to work for the New York Times and has created this, let's say, right-of-center opinion publication. And now Barry Weiss has become the editor-in-chief of CBS News.
She has no experience, and she's very divisive, and people have strong opinions about Barry Weiss's editorials or her positions on certain things. I'm looking past that. I'm looking at her ability to run what was once the Tiffany Network, the most important network news organization in our country. I realize that it's fallen, and maybe this is a, Hail Mary pass to try to resurrect it and to bring it into the, the digital age in a more formidable way. But I just think that there are far more capable people out there, because running a news operation isn't as simple as sitting at the top of the heap and having opinions about which way a story should go. It's making some really hard decisions.
There's that, and there's also the concern about what's going to happen with CBS and its news-making decisions. Last month, when they were busy caving to the Trump administration, one of the things that they agreed to do was to have, for example, Face the Nation would now air only interviews that are conducted live or are pre-recorded with no cuts or edits, which maybe somebody says, oh, yeah, we should just be able to see everything. Well, maybe there is a vehicle for that where online you could see the whole unedited version, the raw version. But to present to the public, when you have, say, a 15-minute segment or a half-hour show or even an hour show, you have to have the editorial sense to be able to condense that, or the point that's going to be important to your readers or listeners, or you're going to miss it.
Well, as we know, politicians are good at filibustering.
Oh, yes.
And there was a time when NPR News went through a cycle, which is now over, of doing live interviews on the air with political figures, and discovered that they weren't getting at the truth of things, because a politician could say whatever they wanted to, and in the span of maybe you have 5 minutes for an interview on a radio newscast, if it's like All Things Considered or Morning Edition, they weren't getting at the truth of things because they couldn't edit.
Sure, you can ask a question, and they could choose not even to really answer that question, but launch into their baloney and monopolize the whole time.
And can you imagine? I don't think that you should malign baloney that way. I like baloney. Anyway, sorry. Go
ahead. Can you imagine if a newspaper reporter or a print reporter had to print every word of every interview they ever conducted? It would be unwieldy, boring, and you don't let people just wander and say whatever you want. That's one of the things we've talked about when we have discussed whether or not the cable news network should air unfiltered these Trump press conferences that go on for 2 or 3 hours, because they need to break away, because it's rhetoric, it's propaganda, it's not true, and at the end of the day, it's not helpful for the reader or the listener.
Yeah. Another topic that you said you wanted to talk about, and I think we need to get into pretty quickly here, is the Pentagon. What's going on there? There are now press access rules at the Pentagon. Journalists now cut off from getting into the Pentagon in most of the areas, I believe, and they will be denied Pentagon press credentials if they don't agree to only publish information that is officially released. Isn't that correct? This is troubling.
So they have supposedly modified the demands of what they're going to ask people to sign on to, but it is still not going to be good enough. There shouldn't be any reason for anybody representing the press to have to agree to publish or not publish certain information. It leaves them open to prosecution, to harassment, and it also, I think, endangers the people who are providing the information to them. So it's terribly dangerous. They should not agree to that at all.
And you've got to wonder what kind of access or privileges the right-wing media that's now covering the Pentagon are getting that mainstream media isn't. Is Newsmax getting special access? They are getting the spots that were once held by, mainstream news reporters who are now doing their work from their cars in the parking lot. I mean, a really good reporter probably doesn't need to roam the halls of the Pentagon. I'm telling you that there's some really good stories that will come about if they do roam those halls. And the other thing that it's doing, it's setting a huge damper on the ability of anybody who works for the Pentagon to come forth and tell us of anything important.
Right, I think it's there to scare them as much as the reporter.
Absolutely, but I think it should be pointed out that the way that government secrets are often released is that the government decides they want to. right, an assistant secretary of defense will leak something to a reporter because the government decides it is in the government's interest to do that. Now that is being precluded, which somebody who is a really experienced reporter, which Secretary Pete Hegseth was not, remember, he was a backup weekend anchor. So this is how reporting gets done. People have information that they want out there, which is now going to be, in effect, criminalized by the Pentagon. Also, we should point out, the Pentagon is the largest government building in any government of the United States, and it was built at taxpayer expense. It is a public facility, and to say that the public no longer is allowed to have access to it seems to me to be really an abrogation of government's responsibility to taxpayers.
So back to what Judy was saying about reporters doing their job regardless, I read that the reporter at The Atlantic, who has covered the Pentagon for a long time, Nancy Youssef, if I'm saying her name correctly, she says, if I lose my credentials, I'm staying on the beat, and I'm just going to do everything I can do to keep doing my job. They just won't have those official press releases. It's harder.
I just don't think we can get outraged enough about this. What is happening to the press's ability to do the job is incredibly horrible. And, you know, I'd like to just take the time to say we all need to stand up. We in the press and the people who depend on us for information, we need to stand up and say this is not tolerable. You cannot do this, but they are doing it.
Yeah, and it's happening in other countries where journalists are being arrested and charged with crimes that really have nothing more to do than criticizing the government. And this is where they are with this.
Well, it is where we are because journalists are being arrested routinely during demonstrations. We actually, a journalist who is a lawful resident of the United States, who is now marked for deportation, for simply doing his job, for simply asking questions that the Trump administration finds to be uncomfortable. Part of the difficulty, though, is I think brought upon by the media itself for not standing together. When the White House decided to bar the Associated Press for not bowing to Trump's demand that it refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, where was the White House press corps? Where were all the other reporters who wouldn't say, we're not going to report any of this, we're going to be different, we're not going to show up if you're going to exclude the Associated Press? I'm just afraid that the media has not done a good enough job of standing up to this kind of repression. And we're still not doing a good enough job, I think, day in and day out, in calling this kind of repression exactly what it is. Am I missing something? I mean, how can we get at what's going on in America if we don't pretty clearly call out this move toward tyranny as being exactly that?
Right. There's too much, I don't know if it's sane washing or sugarcoating or in an effort to try to appeal more to the right. I'm seeing the slow creep of both sidesism back into our industry where, you know, well, there's this and then there's that. When we're not at a point in our society or our democratic society where there is this and that, there's wrong. And there's wrong and there's right. Asking reporters to sign a pledge not to say anything bad about the Pentagon before you're allowed to report about the Pentagon is wrong. Killing the First Amendment is wrong. Assaulting people in the streets of Chicago is wrong. Taking people away without any due process is wrong. And I think too many of these headlines are not being blunt enough about what is happening. And I think that's part of our problem. We're too worried about people trusting us. And as a result, people aren't trusting us.
That's a great point. Take what's happening in Portland, Oregon, as an example, that any time that is reported on, it needs to be said that Trump is relying on photos from 2020. Going back to the local reporting, we can see in Portland that this is not what's happening. We can see that the people who are protesting at the ICE facility in Portland are being egged on, and so that will turn into something bad. We have to stay on top of that. And when the reporters who are having a chance to ask the president a question, when he doesn't answer the question, it drives me nuts that the next person doesn't call him on it. I know that then you can lose your right to ask a question next time, but you can't let them off the hook with a non-answer.
I have to keep trying. You're exactly right.
Totally agree.
I was reading a piece from a couple of months ago by a woman named Lisa Armstrong, who's a professor at Berkeley, a journalism professor, who has done some historical research and notes that the New York Times in 1933, when Dachau opened, described it as an educational concentration camp for political prisoners, a Nazi college, Dachau. That's now, of course, 1933, maybe they couldn't know better. I am pretty sure that a reporter looking at that with clear eyes knew what was going on, should have known what was going on here. But I am afraid that while it's offensive to many people to draw that line, we need to be very clear that we are no longer in a place where we can just cast an eye on what is going on in Washington and try to treat it as though this is an ordinary time. It is not. And the difficulty is our decades-long devotion to objectivity and reporting, which had very good reason. You know, we wanted to be sure we weren't telling people what to think, just giving them information. But I think that was well-intentioned neutrality that has, in fact, failed our audiences. So I hope that we are understanding that differently. But, you know, what we see actually on local levels, too, is local politicians ape Trump. They try to do the same sort of thing. They attack people personally. They divert attention from what's real. So it affects all of us as well, even on our local level.
You know, I think the one hope for the future is the local news, the fact that if you have a local reporter or a local editor or a local publisher out there shaking hands, talking to people, writing stories that matter to the community, you can slowly rebuild that trust. And at the national level, I think they need to try harder. I think they need to cover more stories in a day than just repeating the same story again and again. I understand that the audiences come and go throughout the day, but there's a lot going on in this world, and especially at the local level. What's happening with ICE? What's happening with the tariffs? All those stories, where are they? I was anxiously awaiting them. I've seen a few, but I haven't seen continued coverage. I come back and my coffee prices are sky high. What happened? What's going on with the price of Christmas trees? There's a million tariff stories that nobody's doing because there aren't that many of us left. There isn't that much space in the paper anymore. Or maybe people don't care, but these are real world implications. And I think whenever something like that happens, we need to spring into action.
It is harder these days. One note of how things are going is the Buffalo News has just announced that they're only going to print 6 days a week. I think this is something we'll see more and more of. It's happened in many cities. Syracuse years ago stopped printing the print edition, saying, yeah, we know we're leaving some money on the table because there are ads that we won't be selling for those other days of the week that we're not printing, but we need to get people moved over to digital. It's just a mark of the times that journalism organizations don't have that breadth, but you have to keep at doing what you can.
But reading a newspaper should be a daily habit, and if you take one of those days away, it erodes the habit, and that's
just
what I worry about.
Look online. I have to tell you that that's the least of my worries. If they're keeping the staff and they're reporting the news online, where most people are getting the news, it does not bother me a whit that they are publishing only 6 days a week or 5 days a week or even 4 days a week. But they have to be out there. The support for the media has to bubble up from the public.
This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you want to have your voice heard, media at WAMC.org is how you can reach us. And we are always glad to hear from you. I'm Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. And we are talking about what's going on in journalism these days. In a segment that we will add to some episodes of the Media Project, we'll call it Newsbreakers. Today, we welcome Glenn Kessler as our newsbreaker. For many years, veteran journalist and longtime columnist and fact-checker for The Washington Post. And he is the recipient of the 2025 Nellie Bly Award for Investigative Reporting. That's going to be presented in Albany on Thursday, the 16th of October. Glenn, in Washington at this moment, how are you?
Good.
Terrific. Now, you left the Post a few months ago now, and you're now writing independently on Substack, but you're still doing the work of essentially calling balls and strikes, right?
Yes. I mean, it was somewhat unexpected, my decision to leave the Washington Post. The Washington Post offered a very generous voluntary buyout program. And when I crunched the numbers, I realized financially I would have been stupid not to take it. So that's why I left the Washington Post, along with probably 100 or so of my colleagues.
Absolutely. And you're now in this independent world, as I am too. I'm writing on Substack as well since I left the Times Union. And how are you finding that? The business of being your own boss, in effect.
Well, you know, for the longest time at the Washington Post, as running the fact checker column, I was my own boss. And the Post gave me tremendous freedom. I could choose any subject I wanted to write about. I was responsible for the famous Pinocchio ratings. So in many ways, there's not that much difference. I mean, I don't have a copy editor now. I got to figure that out on my own. And I was never really the best copy editor. but So far, it seems to be working okay. It's hard to judge how successful these things are. In the first month, I got 5,000 followers, which seemed okay. And I'm also working on a variety of book projects.
Well, your work has made such a difference, Glenn. I mean, I really think that so many of us depended upon your column for giving us insight into what lies behind a news story. And I think that's why the Museum of Political Corruption decided to give you this Nellie Bly Award, because it's an award for investigative reporting. And I think it'd be a good idea for you to just explain to our readers a little bit about why we might, in fact, include your kind of work, a fact-checking column, as being really, I think, the epitome of investigative reporting. How do you think that what you have done in that column for these many years, how is that any different from other journalism? What sets this apart, do you think, from day-to-day reporting? Or is it anything?
Well, at its heart, the fact-checker was always very much a policy-oriented column. You know, the bread and butter of politicians is to set policies that affect people's lives. And you have to look upon politicians as kind of like used car salesmen. They're going to try to sell you something, and they're not going to tell you the faults or the problems. You have to figure that out on your own. So the idea was to take statements made by politicians and subject them to scrutiny. What's behind those statistics they're using? How did they manipulate those statistics in order to make things look better or worse than they claim? And I had always thought it was a form of investigative reporting, so I was very gratified to receive the Nellie Bly Award, because it takes a lot of work and effort to find the right documents, to find the right statistics, to find the right sources, and to get to the actual truth of what is happening. And because what I found is that the more complicated a subject is, for instance, federal budget policy or healthcare policy, two very complicated issues that most people have difficulty understanding, the more complicated an issue is, the more likely politicians are able to stretch the truth.
Yes, and the federal government, of course, is filled with complex issues, as you note, that require that kind of analysis. But what is interesting about your coverage of the Trump administration, which I should note, your column predated this era of Washington politics. But what's noteworthy is I think that you found that he would repeat untruths and some of your multiple Pinocchio awards, notwithstanding the fact that you had uncovered fact that disputed his assertions that hasn't seemed to have much impact. Have we kind of entered a post-truth era in American politics? Does it even matter to news consumers anymore whether something is true?
Well, that's a very good question. Yes, I started doing the fact checker in 2011. And initially, people like Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, they responded to fact checks. You know, I mean, it's not like I wrote fact checks to change the behavior of politicians. It was more to inform ordinary citizens. But they would get embarrassed and they would adjust their talking point or their claim because they were called out of having said something that was false. In the case of Donald Trump, he doesn't really care. I mean, he did talk about how he hated to get Pinocchios. He'd complain about Pinocchios, but then he'd keep saying the same falsehoods over and over. And he showed a lot of politicians that maybe I don't really have to adhere to the truth. I can just, you know, make my own reality. And then particularly with the very partisan people on both sides, that reality becomes their truth. I always said that one of Trump's secret sauces when he ran for president the first time was he listened to talk radio, right-wing talk radio, and then he regurgitated what he heard on talk radio in his speeches. And a lot of those people were thinking, wow, there's finally a politician that's telling the truth, because he was simply repeating back the crazy conspiracy claims that they were saying on talk radio.
Remarkable. Same thing still seems to be going on. It appears that his dispatch of troops to Portland was a result of watching Fox News and a 5-year-old video clip, right?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it becomes this crazy feedback loop where his policies are determined by his fantasies, and he can't distinguish that, oh, this is just B-roll that Fox added in from 5 years ago. And he says repeatedly, you know, it's a war zone. I've seen the video. I'm sending troops. And there's no one now really, I mean, the guardrails are kind of gone. So in the first term, there might have been someone that said, no, Mr. President, what you saw was really a 5-year-old video. There's no one in the position close to him that will even bother to say that or be willing to say that. They'll just ride with the falsehood.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more thing, Glenn, and that is the impact that you think fact-checking might have had on reporting in general. It seems to me that as we have seen the kind of work that you have been doing and some others have been doing over the past 15 years, that might have actually strengthened the backbone of reporters or somewhat changed the trajectory of reporting at some of our best news organizations so that this kind of reporting is now imbued into the day-to-day work of some journalists. Is that possibly true, or am I just being overly optimistic here?
No, I think that's true. I think that fact-checking paved the way for many reporters within their articles, particularly with someone like Trump, to say what he said was not verified or this is actually false, and just to put it in the news story. And I used to joke that now everyone is a fact-checker. Believe it or not, in 1996, when I worked at Newsday, where you also once worked, I wrote what was the very first fact-checking article for a major newspaper, where I did a preview of the coming debate between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole, and explained, these are the things they're claiming on the campaign trail. They're going to probably say it in the debate, and here's what's true, and here's what's false. And the reason I did that is I was so frustrated that when I tried to insert those corrective lines within the body of my news stories, because I was the chief political correspondent for Newsday at the time, it was always cut for space. This is back when newspapers had to care about space. Maybe it wouldn't be cut now, but the web is limitless. But it was born of a desire to, within the news story, to explain what was factually true.
Well, I think you've had an impact, and I think that that's one of the facts that led the Museum of Political Corruption to recognize you. So I congratulate you on that, and I'd like to invite our listeners to meet Glenn Kessler Thursday, October 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Hearst Media Center. That's in the Times Union building on Albany Shaker Road in Colony. You can get tickets at the door, or you can reserve them in advance by going to museumofpoliticalcorruption.org. Glenn Kessler, congratulations, and thanks so much for taking the time to join the Media Project today.
You're welcome.
And that ends up being the last word for this week. That was Glenn Kessler and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick is here. I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us. Hope you come back again next week for another edition of the Media Project.
Such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the day.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.